Cooper and yours truly, and we're taking a walk through some uncharted territory thanks to Pizarro and his extraordinary abilities, who has contributed so much. And we've been hearing Harry read from some of his emails. If you've got more to read, please go right ahead. And this woman, but I'm still looking at this woman sitting at the table. She looks like, and you look at the look at her face, she's, if you look in her eyes, she looks like somebody who knows much more than she's saying. She just looks that way. All right?
Yeah.
She just does it. What am I going to tell this gringo to get him off my back?
Get this old fart out of my house.
Yeah. He's drinking my fruit juice. God. And
yeah, you left. Two you glasses left, of fruit juice there, as I recall.
Well, when you showed up with, I see your pink bag behind her shoulder there, and she probably thought that was weird, too. Oh, well, all right.
I don't know where you hang out, but that ain't my pink bag.
Okay. I see the fan, too, right behind you. It must have been hot there. Or was she sweating because she was trying to hide so much?
No, that was summertime down there.
Yeah,
February is summertime, and it was
in the
90s and a lot of humidity. It's a beautiful place down there. I mean, her house was kind of a hovel, but the area is nice.
Let's speculate about this 390, this huge plane. It lands there.
Yep.
This was planned. Obviously, they had a radio transmitter there for the pilot to get his bearings and come We think he came in at night, pretty much. They would have had to have some lights along, some fires burning along the pasture then for him to see. He's got lights, we know that, but still, he put out small fires in long rows on each side of the landing zone.
And there was nobody there to see it because it was, you know, 1945,
right.
Not a whole lot of people.
No. That's fascinating. That's an amazing story. And the plane could have been there 2-3 days before they had a prearranged location to take it after this one. And it took off very shortly thereafter and went to its happy hunting ground or wherever it went. Who knows?
We have information that it was flying until 1966.
Now, that's amazing. Anybody seeing that flying around in the sky would have been mind blown in 1966. Or
but
19...
again, pretty desolate area up there.
Where the plane
is now.
Well, whoever owns it clearly, if it still exists, realizes the incredible historical importance of that and probably has it parked in some large building out in the middle of the jungle.
That's what we're told.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder where she... got the tattoos. They probably didn't have too many tattoo parlors there when she was a kid. They may be homemade tattoos.
I don't know. They look pretty uniform, so. But there's no color. It's all just black ink.
Right.
Or dark blue, whatever. But
right.
Yeah, you're right. No tattoo parlors that I know of there.
No. Very good. Okay. Well, excellent. So we will move on. I'm going to look at this house again. Now, how many of these homes would you say, just box houses? This was a German community,
right?
In an agrarian area, I assume.
Right.
And how many houses like this would you say there were? This is clearly falling apart and in terrible disrepair. But
they were about every quarter mile or every half mile down this road for about 10 miles, but there were other little roads off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, and every one you'd find, you know, half taken apart cars, 2-3 dogs all chained outside.
Dead cars.
Parking.
Sounds like redneck country.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. This was once a thriving German community, founded back in the 1920s.
Mm.
And because it's Uruguay, the day the war broke out, everything German was outlawed, so the German school couldn't be called a German school anymore. And they hauled the headmaster off. Nobody ever saw him again.
Huh.
So.
And now, that wasn't the case in Paraguay, right?
No, just the opposite. All the South American countries pretty much were aligned with Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Paraguay probably more than any of them, but Uruguay was aligned with England.
Right.
So,
now, we got Paraguay and the former president, Alfredo Stroessner, right?
Stroessner.
Uh-huh. And what's his background?
Well, I think from his heritage, he was German.
Yeah, obviously, but did he move there as an adult? Was he born there? Do we know anything about him? Because he was there for a long... He was president for quite a while.
Probably until his death. That's the way it worked with those people down there. His son is a senator down there, so when I go down again in March, I'm going to see if we can't sit down and chat with his son.
Yeah, he'll have... He knows a lot. He knows a lot. That's another gold mine of information. You know that we really want to direct people to the expedition down there where you went to that hotel. I know we've talked about this for your regulars before, but that out of the way, that hotel was in Paraguay, correct?
The resort where Mengele was staying? Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, that is a huge story. Especially since Holdeen drew a picture of it, and that
right in 1962, a picture from the air.
The just amazing.
When Anna Reich was down there and took Holdeen up and flew her over the ranch.
Yeah, where they were staying.
Whatever you want to call it, we're going down there again, as I say, in March, if we can get our ducks in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a box buried on the. On the ranch, and we know about where it is, and one of our members, who lives about 40 miles away from me here, has a
metal detector. Very good.
That can go down 10 meters. Meters.
You better bring a backhoe with you.
Well, yeah, the farmer, my friend Dr. Franco made the mistake of telling the farmer who owns it. Now, what we're looking for, and the farmer is about wetting his pants. Oh, good, it's full of Nazi gold. Everything is Nazi gold. We told him, no gold in it. And if you come with a backhoe, you're going to destroy it. It's a time capsule.
Oh, well, we shouldn't have told him.
Well, Dr. Franco is not as snicky as I am.
Mm-hmm. But, all right. Okay. August 6th, Mar del Plata, again, Argentina, U530 on the right. Photo courtesy Pizarro, U977 on the left.
Yeah. Before I get into that, I'll just put my last note about the people, my editor note here in the next magazine. What Pizarro describes and what I experienced almost sound like a rehearsed reply. Maybe even a well-planned conspiracy to keep certain secret things to remain secret. So now Pizarro continues, and that explains. Now I've never seen this picture before. The two boats together. They both surrendered in Mar del Plata.
Mm-hmm.
U530 was in July, and about 8 days later, U977 surrendered in there. The interesting thing. U530 was a Type 9C, and it had fuel to reach there. U977 was a Type 7C that didn't have that kind of a range. It left Norway with a full crew, torpedoes and everything. It went down to its combat area off England, and then they got the surrender order. They went back to Norway, disembarked the married men, and without refueling, went all the way to South America. That's you jumping in your car with one load of fuel and deciding to drive to New Orleans.
Well, if you look at a map, it's downhill, so they just coasted.
Well, that's true.
Now, the other thing is they had these they call them milk cows, right? The big refueling subs?
Yeah, Type 14s.
And there may have been one or two still out there in service.
No, they were all dead early on. They were all sunk quickly.
Were they?
Yeah,
too big of a target.
One, yeah, well, it was a big, easy target, but and it was a dangerous target because if they stayed in operation, they could keep front boats, combat boats, unseen longer.
Sure.
And also their security was horrible. One was U-505, I think the other one was U-217, were refueling off of a milk cow on calm ocean, all sitting still. As soon as they came to the surface, the two combat boats had double lookouts and they had men on the anti-aircraft guns. On the milk cow, the guys were standing around at the rail smoking cigarettes. Nobody was manning the guns. And then when both boats took on their fuel and headed out, they got about 1 hour away, and all of a sudden they could hear the Type 14 on the radio telling the base, you know, what they had fueled, mm-hmm. and they were mm-hmm. on the air for like 5 minutes or so, and the guys on the combat boat thought, holy cow, they pulled the plug and dived, and within a half an hour they could hear bombs in the area of the Type 14 boat, and then it was no more.
Right.
So by 1944, they were all gone.
Mm-hmm.
So
that doesn't mean
fuel, who knows? But
they could have had any kind of a large merchant appearing ship.
Who knows?
Who knows? But they got fuel somewhere. Yeah.
The skipper of U-977, Heinz Schaefer, wrote a book about his last patrol. And he said that he got improved fuel economy by snorkeling, running submerged for 66 days.
No, that doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. Look at that big, ugly conning tower. You got to push that through the water.
The drag on that is huge.
Right. So that we know that's horse feathers. I'm in contact with his son, but his son, of course, is like Sergeant Schultz. I see nothing. I hear nothing. I know nothing. But I'm going to visit with him next time I'm in his area and see if we can't learn a little more.
How do you say, don't take it with you in German?
I don't know. I'll have to look that one up. So anyhow, let's see what the significance of these two boats are. Aside from the fact they both surrendered at Mar del Plata, they both said that they didn't know that the other one was planning to be there, and they both said that they decided they would surrender in a place where their men would be treated with dignity. It's almost like they had the same rehearsed speech, but probably didn't. Anyhow, here we continue with Pizarro's email.
Okay.
He says, I met the co-pilot in Uruguay.
Co-pilot said, of the JU-390.
390, yeah. And he said that their airplane was on the right landing course, 300 meters above the ground. That's about 1,000 feet, I guess, and almost 1,000. And
Harry, excuse me. Would you please back up? I got lost there when you switched to 390 there. You're reading from Pizarro. He said, I met the co-pilot. And then the co-pilot is telling him about a flight? Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, when they were coming to Uruguay.
Okay, to the meadow, the big, long meadow.
That's right.
Okay.
He said they were 300 meters above the ground.
Okay.
At only 80 knots and landed at 75 knots. In this remote, he goes on, he says, in this remote area, there were not many estancias. He smiled and he told me, in July and August 1945, all U.S. agents and British agents looked to the Argentine port of Mar del Plata because two big German Reich U-boats were there. He raised his glass in a toast and said this was the best camouflage for the airplane. That's these two boats. All the U.S. and British agents figured that's where Hitler was going to come ashore, was in these submarines.
They were all looking for submarines.
They were concentrating everything. Mm-hmm. Mar del Plata, Argentina, which is about 400 miles south of Buenos Aires, whereas this airplane landed in Uruguay, which is in a whole different direction.
So what we have is the co-pilot of the 390
yep.
admitting to Pizarro that he did, in fact, land in Uruguay.
Yep.
That's astounding. Thank you again, Pizarro, if you're listening. Thank you for that.
Yeah, he's been a good friend for a lot of years.
Wow. What a score. Great score.
Yep.
Okay, so we have confirmation now that the 390 landed. We're not going to get any word on the passengers or cargo, of course, but you have to figure it out. Why would a plane like that make a flight like that, probably without having to refuel, and land?
Well, he did not have to refuel.
In the middle of nowhere, for what reason? What would he be carrying? What's he doing? All right, well, you can figure it out. It doesn't take a rocket scientist.
So anyhow, my comment there in the magazine, in this extremely rare photograph provided by Pizarro, we note that the best camouflage meant that everyone was looking in the area of Mar del Plata for the escaping Germans because the two U-boats surrendered there, and apparently nobody thought to look to any other part of South America. So then Pizarro goes on, and he says, many years later, I had the meeting with Otto Wermuth. Commander Wermuth and I... And I asked him about the big Ju-390, but he knows nothing of this airplane. He said he was only a U-boat skipper and knew nothing about airplanes.
That's funny. That's funny. Right. That goes back to the first picture of the three gentlemen, and the middle man with the white face is Pizarro.
Yep.
Wermuth is on the right. He says, I saw nothing. I know nothing. I remember less.
Yeah,
I got
that's it. So... here I go on. What is still unexplained. Now, this comes up in our second book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance.
Uh-huh.
What is still unexplained, or maybe it's explained through common sense, when we add the number of surrendered U-boat men from U-530 and U-97 for repatriation after the war, there are many more U-boat men than just these two crews. The total U-boat men, equal enough for three U-boats. And then I say, one must wonder, but that's a story for another time. So that's why we think the third boat.
It's in that estuary, that bay. Is that the one?
That's the one we think it is. Yeah, in the Caleta de los Loros.
And as Harry tells us, it can be, apparently, sometimes pilots will see it, it's outlined in the water, depending on the conditions of the light and so forth.
And if they've got a strong neap tide, mm-hmm. or ebb tide, one or the other, low tide, if they got an extremely low tide, because if the wind is offshore, you know, it drives the water further out. So it's been seen by... witnesses, allegedly, it's been in newspapers down there for years. People.
Oh,
see it.
Really? So they have stories about it. Oh, interesting.
But when they go down to look for it, they can't find it.
Uh-huh.
And that's somewhat explained in our book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance.
Any guess about the number of that boat?
No. And a lot of the boats, you know, some of the black boats were like our SR-71s. Our SR-71s, most of them were assigned to the CIA, not the Air Force, and some of the submarines were assigned to the Abwehr or the SS, I don't know. But they were black boats. Some of them, they just weren't even on paper. So now we come to the new stuff that I didn't have time. It was coming in so fast, Jeff, I didn't have time to do anything with it. The photos, etc. So, and this is where I'm going to be a little dodgy.
All right.
Because this is some really hot intel, and it's in the magazine. It's in our next magazine, so our members will read it. But I don't want to help George of the Jungle.
And, no, understand.
Yeah, so here I'm kind of reading out of the next magazine, Where the Big Bird Flew.
What was the last year the plane allegedly was flying?
1966, in Paraguay. Now, this is my words, but from what I got from Pizarro. Ju-390V1 was used for training and testing only. V3 was never completed, broken up by either the retreating Germans or the victorious Allies. V2 was built 3 meters longer than V1, so it had more fuel capacity and a longer range. We knew this aircraft flew to Uruguay, and at the end of the war, we're quite certain Hitler was aboard. But that was not the first flight of this big bird. This is something that was new to me just in the last day or two from what Pizarro was releasing. And this is confirmed by another agent who is currently in the spook works, who didn't even know Pizarro. He confirmed that this big bird had made previous flights. So let me continue with this here.
All right.
Now we go back to another email from Pizarro that I just got 2 days ago. With his meeting with the co-pilot of the 390 in Uruguay. Pizarro asked him about the flight of V2 to Japan in March 1945 and back to Germany. He said he was not on board at the time, but the pilot for the Japan pilot flight was one of the German test pilots based at Rechen, northwest of Berlin.
Uh-huh.
At this time, KG-200, remember, Kampfgeschwader 200 was the bomber squadron that had all the secret stuff.
By the way, they also had B-17s, B-24s captured that they were flying. They had German markings on them. I have a book about KG-200. You have the same book.
Okay. And the commander of that was Werner Baumbach. And he was one of the three that restructured the Argentine Air Force. But unfortunately, he was on board a Lancaster bomber training some Argentine pilots, and they crashed into the Mar del Plata, and he couldn't get out, and he drowned. So this was well after the war. So anyhow, let's see where I leave off here. Okay, he said that it went to Japan, and this time KG-200 was in Rechlin, and in February 43 was a test flight at Rechlin for the V2. So it is possible that the flight to Japan carried very important technical drawings, new weapons, and much more. The flight to Japan was on 28-29 March 1945 and back on 30 March. And at the beginning of April 45 was on an airfield near Prague. Here we're talking about another submarine, but...
What was the duration of that flight to Japan?
I don't know. He didn't say.
Uh-huh. Okay. I mean, what was the time out and time back? Did you just not give me that?
Yeah. 28th of March going out and back on the 30th of March. Awful quick turnaround.
Man, that's nonstop flying. I wonder what route they would have flown. They would have had to go over the Mediterranean... And south, where would they go? They went right over the top. Okay.
Yep. That was my thought, too. I said, how could they do that? If he flew to the west, he got across the U.S. If he flew to the east, he got across Russia. That doesn't work. So anyhow,
that's guts. That is really guts, going over the pole like that.
Well, it's following orders.
Yeah.
And the airplane was back near Prague. He goes on here. Yeah, the 390 flight to Japan on 28 March 1945 was over the polar route. And it landed on blank island, which is one of the Japanese islands. Landed there on 29 March. There are files in Germany with the report on 28 March 1945 about the 390 that flew to Japan and back. The airfield for this flight to Japan was at the airfield at Bardufoss, Norway. The direct flight to Japan went over the north route, over the big Russian Kamchatka Peninsula. Many years later, in 2012... German Luftwaffe Avgas drums of 200 liters, that's a 55-gallon drum, were found on this island near the airfield. All these German Reich fuel drums were stamped with the Reich Eagle in the year 1943. This airfield is on a volcanic island that's snow-free year-round.
Wow.
So there's a picture of the island in the magazine and a close-up picture of the part of the island that's got the remains of the airfield on it.
He sent you pictures of that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, he told me how to get them off Google.
And you see any 55-gallon drums?
Well, we're getting to that.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't zoom in that close in this picture. However, turn to the page. And on that island, during the war, the Japanese army was there, and they had Aichi bombers based there, which the U.S. called Val bombers. And we continue. In the last words of the pilot, I asked him if they had gasoline drums aboard the Ju-390 as a last reserve. The pilot said yes. They had some of these 200-liter drums from the strategic gasoline reserve from KG-200, who had the best gasoline for the Ju-390s. And he said they had some 200-liter drums in the plane as a last reserve. And Pizarro goes on. And so I asked the pilot if I could find some of these drums near the Estancia de 19 April in Uruguay. He just smiled and said, maybe. Pizarro said he was later near this Estancia, and so maybe we can find some of these drums with the German Reich Eagle today or in the next years. So then in his next email, Pizarro said, on this island of blank,
such
blank,
and such, yeah,
blank, blank, you can still see the Japanese gun emplacements and the old Japanese runway, and there are as many as 500 rusty drums today. But those were red drums, whereas the German ones were white. But in this stock, in this batch, in 2012, were found three German Reich Luftwaffe drums from 1943.
Wow.
Let's see. He goes on to say V1 was only test flights, no special missions, because it didn't have the long range. And talks about V2 being on the airfield at Schweidnitz. We've talked about that. After the war, Major General, later on he was Lieutenant General, Fritz Morczyk, was head of all Luftwaffe transport squadrons, was in the U.S. after the war, and he wrote a special report for the U.S. Air Force, and in this report, he wrote that the Ju-390 V-2 had some flights to Japan. Some flights. So, then my notes... It's possible that when I return to the Estancia and the Colonia, I might find some of the German Reich fuel drums. Okay, so then we go on to the next. This gets incredible. And this is all in the next issue of my KTB. It came in so fast, I didn't get a chance to get it to you.
Got it.
Excuse me. Okay. Pizarro goes on and said a Russian expedition to this island in 2012 found these German Reich oil drums. One of the V-1 test pilots was Oberst Hans Patches. He was born da-da-da. And he was in Reichland in 1940. He worked for Junkers as a test pilot for the Ju-90 and the 290. Four-engine plane, and later for the Ju-390 V-1, and then was a test pilot for the Me-163 rocket fighter.
Gee.
And other planes.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, he was interviewed by a newspaper in his hometown in Spain, and he stated that he flew JU-390 to Cape Town and back, but we have not found files in Germany for this Cape Town flight in V-1. After the war, he flew for the U.S. Army, etc. Well, then my editor note, our other Sieg agent, Peter Parker, confirmed that the Cape Town flight was true. Peter Parker is the guy who's currently working.
Right.
So, in the next email, I don't know if this is important, but anyhow, he answered some of my questions. They don't have the name of the air crew. Then he says, very important, you have seen the photo of blank-blank island with the many red fuel drums.
Mm-hmm.
Harry, I know the drums of the Strategic Reserve of KG-200 in 1943 were white. In the photos of blank-blank island, we see some white drums. Excuse me. We think this Russian expedition has found in the many red drums some white German rice drums. In October 1969 in Uruguay, the co-pilot said to Pizarro that they had 10 drums with gasoline on board as a last reserve,
mm-hmm.
and each drum held 200 liters with gasoline, which is 55 gallons. So he had 550 gallons of reserve. So...
The red drums would have been gasoline provided by the Japanese.
Well, could be. I don't know. But all I know is the white ones.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a scene out of that comedy movie, The Airplane, or Airline, Airport, whatever. You know,
yeah,
the red,
red
zone is for... Okay, so anyhow, Pizarro asked him... Now, this is Pizarro continuing. He says, I asked him what color were the drums aboard his plane, and he said they were white. We looked later in Germany into photo files of wartime fuel drums and found white drums with black letters. So it is possible the Russians found white drums with black swastika in 1943 mm-hmm. on Blank Blank Island. We do not think the Russians have destroyed the German Reich drums and think that there are all German Reich drums on this island today. And then he goes on to say, it is possible you will find these white drums in Uruguay,
mm-hmm.
in the area of the Estancia. In the next email from Pizarro, he says that German Reich Minister Albert Speer wrote in his book about the JU-390 V-2 flights by the polar route to Japan in 1945.
Hmm.
And the pilots were Kuchler and Karl Patton. From what Pizarro has said, it is thought that the JU-390 V-2 flights to Japan began as early as late 1944, and we know for sure in March 1945. We have established that the six-engine JU-390 V-2 flew from the well-defended airfield at Schweidnitz to Uruguay, where it landed on the Estancia that Martina and I visited in February 2016. Then we show some photos of this island. First, we have a photo of a disheveled gun emplacement. It's, you know, it's falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
These photos were shot in 2012 by the Russian expedition. Then there's a photo of what appears to be a rusty large lamp. Then there's a photo of a guy climbing out of a tunnel. This Japanese built tunnel just like the Germans did. Then we got a photo of Russian scuba divers going through some kind of a floor hatch down into the water.
Huh.
Then we have a photo of the abandoned runway with a bunch of red oil drums lined up along the side of the runway, and if you look real close, there's a white one in
mm-hmm.
there. These
mm-hmm.
are the photos mm-hmm. that I just got today. And then the last photo is a German Reich oil drum on that island.
Up close,
where you can read it, just the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
It says Kraftstoff 200 Naturgefahrliche Wehrmacht, 1943, mm-hmm. and it's got the German anchor.
Wow, so what a story.
I got so far.
Well, that's incredible information. That plane, multiple trips to Japan, who knows, 2, 3, 4, Cape Town, certainly one trip to Uruguay, probably the last trip, until it flew again in the 1966, or maybe who knows what was going on with that. That plane, very likely that plane is hidden away somewhere, as you know. We've talked about this.
Yeah, that's what we're told, that it's hidden away. But, and I'm also told that it's in what had once been.
Now, don't give anything away if you need to. Keep this under your hat.
Yeah, but I'm not going to say where, but it was a former Paraguay Air Force base, mm-hmm. and it was in a hangar, but now it's privately owned, and instead of military, they've got private security that supposedly shoots first and asks questions later.
This is Paraguay or Uruguay?
This is in Paraguay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an incredible plane with an incredible footnote in history that I'm interested. For those of you who have libraries, many of you probably have or may have had Albert Speer's book. He wrote one or two of them, and it would be in that book, the Ju-390 V2.
Yeah, it's you know how excited I don't get that excited very often, but you saw it in my emails. Wow, outstanding and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, by the way, hi, Steve. Steve Carlisle just sent us an email. One of your listeners.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. Yeah. Well, we have, as you said, we have people all over the world listening. This is extraordinary information, and there's more to come. It sounds like Pizarro is gifting you with some his A material. Not that he's ever held back from you, but he's making sure it gets into the right hands in case his health gets worse and more of a struggle. We all hope that you get better, Pizarro, and I know that if you utilize that all-natural substance, which was discovered by a German physician in the 1970s. It has been extraordinarily successful in dealing with immunological challenges, as I have to say, like you're facing. And just make sure you take enough of it. There's a capsule, and there is also a liquid protocol that goes with it. You take a small bit of liquid, and you take 3 capsules a day. But contact the people who sell it. They will help you. Use my name if you want. And it can do wonderful things.
Yeah,
I
keep him in my prayers every
Absolutely.
Night.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because he's not only been an incredible source of history, he's a good friend. He's a good friend. We've tromped through mountain jungles together, mountain forests, woodlands, whatever the heck you want to call it. And he knows where, he's the one who showed me where that very special bunker was up on, I think it's up on over Salzburg.
Over Salzburg? The one up. Okay.
Yeah, I think it's there. But this is the one where, unlike any other bunker, which the other bunkers are all sterile, they're concrete, well-built and everything, this one we think was a special bunker for Hitler along his walkway because you go down 12 stairs. We've covered this before. But
we have pictures of it, don't we?
Right, exactly. In our last show. The number 12 was very big for the Reich. 12 disciples of Christ, mm-hmm. 12 knights of the round table. And you walk down 12 stairs into this bunker, if you want to call it that, crypt. And there were 12 pillars, and each pillar had 12 corners. And when we went there in 1988, I think it was, everything was pristine, just like they had walked out. There was no furniture or anything left, but there was one room that looked like it might have been a living room, restroom, whatever, a smaller kitchen, and a bathroom. The toilet was gone, but the piping and valves were all there.
Uh-huh.
And we think this was a place where Hitler had been resting on his walks, because he walked through the mountains all the time. Or maybe it was a place to duck in if it started raining, whatever. So, and then we found right near there, about 10 meters away, I found a big flat steel plate in the ground about 4 feet by 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And Pizarro says, oh, it must be part of this bunker. I said, no, it's in the wrong direction. It's in the other direction. Oh, he says, it must not be important. I says, come on, people don't put a 4 foot by 4 foot steel plate in the ground just for fun. Well, he went back, and yeah, this was in our last show. He went back with Bud Dana, one of our members, who's mm-hmm. now passed away, and they lifted this thing up, and it was a hinged lid to a different bunker. And they went down and took pictures, but unfortunately, Bud kept all the pictures, and then we broke contact some years ago, and
mm-hmm.
we have no idea what was there. And Pizarro never went down into that one. But
so you saw, you found this square plate. It was just rusty in the grass, dirt around it.
Yeah, in mm-hmm. the grass.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it had a thin layer of dirt and grass on top of it.
Right.
And the only way I discovered it, I was walking, and I walked onto it, and all of a sudden the ground was not spongy, it was solid.
Hmm.
And I said, what the heck?
Mm-hmm.
And it's solid in a square. So I started kicking the dirt away, and sure enough, steel plate.
Hmm. Somewhere I have a magazine article written by somebody who knew something about German Advanced Scientific Research Center underground. And I want to say that the underground complex was in Poland. They went into it, and it went a long way. And they had actually a two-rail trolley, we'll call it, a train, whatever. It went. There was a track, and it went on and on and on and on and on. And then the tunnel went down, and they encountered water. It had been flooded. It was full of water. They couldn't go down any lower. And they don't have any idea what was under there. It could have been part of the nuclear research complex, something. But it was very eerie and very... I will hopefully find that again. It must have been 25, 30 years ago I found this magazine.
Well, what you're describing is not uncommon. So many of the German bunkers and tunnels underground had little rail car lines, not for big diesel trains or anything, but, little
transport.
Mine carts and stuff.
Yeah.
The farm that Martin Bormann built right near Hitler's home, the Berghof, it had little rail car things to go in and out to take food into the animals and to take their used-up food out. And in this, what we call the deep bunker, the one where they still have the dynamite in some of the
uh-huh,
glass holes, it had the cutouts for railroad ties to go in there, because it was going to be rails in there. There was another hardened bunker that was built over a rail spur where Göring hid his treasure train. And so these, it's not uncommon to find that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it's not uncommon to find, as you go further and further down, they're flooded. They were not flooded as sabotage to keep people out. They were flooded because it just floods.
Groundwater,
like the Führer bunker in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
It went down several levels, but pretty much last time we heard about it and last time anybody was in there, 1991, I think, The water had been seeping in, and it was pretty flooded.
Right.
And we've got a DVD about that when somebody went in there in 1990, 91, something like that. We've got a DVD about that.
This article I found was very intriguing. And yes, they had complexes all over the place.
Yes, they sure did.
What an amazing people.
Yeah, yeah. And when we go there for our bunker tour in October, like I said, our leader is going to be Jeff Carson. We call him the Tunnel King because if the Germans built anything in that area, he knows where it is. He also took us to the place by Bad Reichenhall where, after the war was over, a small group of French soldiers from the Charlemagne division, wearing German uniforms, I think there were half a dozen of them, they were found by a group of French soldiers wearing U.S. uniforms, but they had their weapons, and they took them prisoner, and I think it was Leclerc, General Leclerc himself, ordered that these guys be shot. It was after the war was over.
Oh, because they deserted, or they didn't fight for France.
Well, they fought on the German side.
Yeah.
And so these French and the American uniforms marched these guys to the edge of a ravine right there.
Come on.
And, yeah, told them, turn around. They were going to shoot them in the back. And the Frenchman and the Charlemagne group said, no, you're going to shoot a French fellow Frenchman. You're going to look at us when they shoot us. So they did. They shot them and then dumped their bodies into the ravine, where the Americans found them about 2 or 3 days later and took their bodies to the nearby town and had them buried in the church cemetery. But Jeff Carson found the spot where these guys had been killed.
Wow.
And somebody locally just put up a small artificial, you know, not a professional, a cross.
Sure.
About maybe 3 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
With red, white, and blue, the French color bunting wrapped around it. And then in the village, in the cemetery, Jeff showed us where the graves were.
Yeah.
You know, and he found where Paula Hitler was buried and where Adolf Hitler's parents were buried in a rush of political correctness. All the markings were removed. From their graves. There's all these beautifully well-attended graves with a little stone wall about 6 inches high around the little garden and nice headstones, except there's this one bare patch of grass, and that's where Hitler's parents are buried.
Well, I wonder how much has been discovered of the German underground from World War II, total. Probably a small percent, 10%. 15, 20.
They're always finding new stuff.
That's what I hear.
Yeah. There was, what was it, in Norway. All of a sudden they had some beach erosion and very low tides, and doggone, they found two. This was about 5-6 years ago. They found a couple of bunkers that were exactly like they were when the day the guys marched out. They just shut the door and left. Everything was in there.
Wow.
Then in Berlin, must have been 10 years ago, I guess, they found not the Führer bunker, but the Fahrer bunker, which was nearby. It was an SS headquarters, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like they had walked out yesterday. Everything was in there.
Wow.
So
see,
what a
tourist attraction that would be if they were smart enough to leave it alone.
Yeah,
they
locked it up again right away, and nobody gets in there except officials for official reasons.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. If they put a turnstile there.
Oh, millions.
They'd have money rolling out the door, but, you know, God forbid.
Yeah, or your brain would turn to mush, one or the other. The Germans had to be building, Harry, 24 hours a day. For endless years.
They were busy.
Yeah, they never stopped. Never stopped. Yeah, this article I hope to find at some point. You'll have it if I do. Very interesting. I think that the rails actually were used to transport in electric, little electric trains that would take people and things back and forth. It was a long distance. It was very well-made tunnels. These scientific tunnels were finished. They weren't just holes in the rock.
Oh, no. Their tunnels were all well finished.
Yeah. Except Owl Mountain. Now, Owl Mountain is something you need to go see at some point if you can.
Yeah, I'm having troubles finding somebody that can show me where I need to be in Owl Mountain.
Yeah.
And also, I understand it's still owned by the Army.
Look up, for those of you listening, it's in Poland, right? Or is it in Germany? East Germany?
I think it's in Germany.
All right.
And the eastern part.
Owl Mountain in eastern Germany, and all the drawings for all the underground tunnels, they were going to put industrial centers in there.
Yeah.
Big, big manufacturing facilities. There were, I think, four or five different tunnel installations there. It was like a city of underground tunnels. And they were, we're talking about 30, 40 feet tall ceilings for industry.
Oh, yeah.
And they did locate a one company moved in there, and I think it had to do with something like uniform manufacturer or something. But Owl Mountain is another unknown, enormous relic from the war. Owl Mountain.
Yeah.
Look that up.
We visit such an underground tunnel on our Southern Patrol. You can see pictures of it on the website.
Go to sharkhunters.com, look under previous tours, and click that page down toward the bottom of it. You'll see another link. A second link is tours, previous tours. Go there, and you can just take these trips anytime you want. They're absolutely fascinating. Well, thank you for sharing all that. Thank you, Pizarro, so much for sharing and for so many years of hard work and contribution. You are more than appreciated. So, Harry, we'll talk soon. Thank you. Wonderful program. Just amazing.
Great. You have a great evening, what's left of it.
Okay.
It's morning here.
All right. All right. Get some shut-eye. Take care.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay. Good night. And that's our program tonight. Wow. There's a walk through history and more to come. All right. Take care. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk soon.